The views and opinions expressed by the guests on the following program do not necessarily represent those of Mark Radio, The Shepherd, or its advertisers.
From the studios of the Shepherd Radio Network, it's Afternoons with Mike. This next hour is all about our walk with Jesus, with local pastors, newsmakers, people who are making a difference for the gospel. Now, here is your host, Mike Gilland.
Welcome back to Afternoons with Mike. It's been a little while now since David Clausen from the Family Research Council was with us, but boy, I'm excited to say he is back again today. Welcome back, David.
Mike, thanks so much for having me on the show. It's really great to be back with you.
Well, I'm excited to have you back. You're a Central Florida native. We talked about that the last time you were with us. And you attended school here in the Orlando area and just got to taste all of what Orlando is all about. With one exception, David, you weren't in Orlando Thursday morning, bright and early, when it was 34 degrees.
Wow. Well, that doesn't make me miss Orlando when it's 34 degrees, but here in Washington, D.C., I think it honestly was about the same, and that is something this Floridian is still struggling with, living in our nation's capital.
Oh, I know it. It can be cold there in more ways than one, for sure. It's chilly on the weather front, and I know that you're dealing with a bunch of things, and man, it just must really be weird, David, to be living in Washington, D.C. in these days, because things have, well, just saying it mildly, things have changed, right?
Things have definitely changed in Washington, D.C., and just, I think we're, you know, 3 weeks, 4 weeks into the Biden presidency, and before we even talk about the policy, it's just been interesting living in the nation's capital. My route to work here into FRC, I've had to change my route because there's still streets, actually, main arteries through the city that are still shut down, that have fences and barbed wire, and we still have National Guard troops that are kind of policing some of the buildings. So it's definitely an interesting time to be here in the city.
You know, I think a lot of people who have heard that the National Guard is still deployed, and I have a relative actually that is there or on his way there, if he's not there already. And it's really surprising. I think a lot of people are surprised they would understand that kind of level of deployment for, let's say, the inauguration. But that's, like you said, a couple of weeks past now. And I guess the big question that a lot of people would have, is there still an ongoing sense of high red alert going on in D.C.?
That's what we're hearing from people in the administration and at other federal agencies, that they think there's some sort of threat. It's interesting, though. It's something that Republicans and Democrats are able to agree on, which, you know, unfortunately, those times of agreement are few and far between. But there is bipartisan calls to say that a lot of this fencing and barbed wire should be taken down, because it certainly sends a message that I think a lot of lawmakers don't want to be sent about kind of having the Capitol on lockdown. And I know there's conservatives in town that are worried that the government, even kind of the federal government, keeping things shut down and locked down almost indefinitely isn't a great thing. And so hopefully, we just got to trust that hopefully the federal officials make the right call and make sure that we're safe, because that's, you know, first and foremost what's important, that our lawmakers are safe. I know a lot of local people here, my neighbors, would be grateful to see things return to a little bit of normalcy.
You know, I had a great chat on the phone with one of the workers, one of the writers for World Magazine, and her name was Harvest Prude, and she gave just such a wonderful firsthand account of actually being in the hall, in the chambers of the House during that invasion. And that was such a sad event, and it's still being sorted out. It's probably going to be argued and talked about for many, many years to come. And I'm sure, as my guest yesterday on the program said, this is going to be an event that, without a doubt, we're going to be looking back at and telling, you'll be telling your grandchildren about it, and maybe they'll be telling their kids about it. for many years to come. What was it like for you being in D.C. during that week?
Yeah, it was really interesting because I actually had to catch a flight out of town. And, of course, everyone was on high alert knowing that there was going to be a big rally near the White House. And that event happened in the morning. And then, obviously, a lot of the people who were near the Capitol, the crowd got bigger. And I was actually driving by the Capitol, kind of unaware of what was going on. I was only maybe 6 blocks away from the Capitol, I think, when it was actually breached, and it was really eerie. And once I got to the airport, it was just very surreal. Everyone was just transfixed on the television sets and whatnot.
Yeah.
But from my drive to from downtown D.C. to the airport, which is only a 15-minute drive, I've never heard so many sirens in the air. When you kind of look towards the Capitol, all you saw was red and blue lights. And there was a lot of motorcades moving around the city very quickly. And so I definitely knew something was going on. There was a palpable sense of fear kind of just in the air. And then when I got to the airport, obviously seeing the images of people inside the Capitol. I've only lived in D.C. for 2 years now, but my normal run takes me by the Capitol. I run right in the shadow of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it really did feel kind of like an attack on our democracy, on our values. And I think that's why it's what happened is received broad condemnation from Republicans, Democrats, conservatives, liberals. And like you said, I know the events are going to be studied, and the president here at FRC, Tony Perkins, has been really clear that, our hope is that the people who are responsible are brought to swift and fair justice.
Yeah, there's absolutely no doubt that we would all agree, and every person, regardless of what side of the aisle they're on, that was a terrible event and should never have happened. And I guess it's still hard, number one, to even believe it did happen, much less why it happened. But, again, this is going to be talked about and fought over for a long, long time. Why don't you give us a quick update as to exactly, you mentioned Tony Perkins and Family Research Council. Give our listeners that may not be as intimately involved or understanding as to what your guys' mission would be at the FRC.
Yeah, of course. Great question, Mike. So FRC, we've been around actually since 1983, and we are a nonprofit research and educational organization. And kind of in our mission statement, we say that we are dedicated to articulating a family-centered philosophy of public life. And so we engage at the federal level and at the state level, on issues that we really care about, those issues being the issue of human life, so obviously the abortion issue, issues related to religious freedom. And I think we'll talk about it on the program later in just a moment, but the issue of SOGI, the sexual orientation, gender identity, things that are being put forward by local, state, and federal officials. And so we really want to foster a culture that respects life and families. And so we do that through lobbying, but we also do that through education and through our pastors network. We have about 14,000 pastors who are on our network. And it's called Watchmen on the Wall,
mm-hmm.
who receive regular briefings from our team here at FRC and resources. And then most immediately, my role here at FRC as the Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview is to provide resources for Christians to think through all of these issues, whether it's political engagement, life, religious freedom, marriage and sexuality. I've written a series of little booklets that your listeners can find at frc.org/worldview that has the goal of just helping Christians understand all of these issues that we're debating in the public square, but from a position that is rooted firmly in God's word. And so that's what we do here at FRC. It's what I do, and it's certainly a joy to be on the front lines fighting for these things that we all care so deeply about.
We do, and I want to say thank you on behalf of all of our listeners. Thank you for the efforts. You know, I'm sure 2 years ago when you came to D.C. to join FRC and to lead in these two major areas, Christian ethics and biblical worldview. It was a different world back 2 years ago with regards to those areas. And you're in the deep end of the pool, so to speak, with all that you're doing right now and having to sort through stuff that's in the daily news. And I think everyone, every Christian is probably still amazed that things have happened in those regards over just a couple of years' time. Such a shift in not only thinking, but now directives actually put into place via executive orders from the new president. And a lot is changing in a very short time.
It really is, Mike. And whether we want to talk about President Biden's executive order on sexual orientation, gender identity, the executive order on transgender people serving in the military, or even the executive order repealing the Mexico City policy that funds abortion overseas. Just those three things right there is a major pivot from what we saw during the previous administration under Donald Trump. And, you know, I know a lot of people have strong feelings about the president in both ways. But I will say just these last couple of weeks, just with those three things, that the executive order on the transgender military service, the executive order funding abortion overseas, and the executive order that I believe really targets people of faith and faith-based organizations on how we define the word sex within the federal government, all three of those things are going to have major ramifications and implications over the next 4 years.
You know, a number of years ago in Florida, John Stenberger, I'm sure you know John, John was a leader, and they put this act out, and it was passed, I think it was called the Family and Marriage Act or something like that, and it was basically defining marriage as being between a man and a wife, a man and a woman, a husband and a wife, and this now, that whole concept, according to what our children, my heart is going out so much for the kids of today, because I am sure the marching orders that are going out to all public schools about how things are talked about what, like you said, the definition of what marriage is all about, the definition of what these things that would be even gender, even that term. And I'm just still shocked and amazed. I'm recently filling out an application for something online, and it gets down just the typical, you get to that place where it's gender, and it used to be two slots there, male or female. And now there's like two or three choices beyond that. You can say non-binary, or you can say not sure. What in the world is going on, David?
Well, you're getting at something important, Mike, which is something that I know Dr. Moeller at Southern Seminary and others, John Stenberger in Florida, who is a friend, what we call kind of the moral revolution and how it really is moving at warp speed. The amendment you're referring to, I believe it was Amendment 2 to the Florida Constitution,
yes,
was passed in 2008,
yes,
which is astounding. That was the same year that Barack Obama won his first term in the White House. And although the majority of Florida voters chose Barack Obama to be president, 62% of Florida voters passed this amendment defining marriage between a man and a woman. That same year in 2008, Proposition 8 passed in California. And again, Barack Obama carried the state overwhelmingly, but there was millions of people who still voted for Barack Obama that still voted to define marriage between a man and a woman. So we're talking 2008. This is not ancient history. This is 2008. And
12 years,
you had
13 years,
broad consensus at the time that this is what marriage is. And obviously the 8 years of the Obama presidency accelerated this moral revolution kind of at warp speed. But it really does look like Joe Biden has picked up and is really, you could say, running a third Obama term on some of these really contentious issues. And again, these are I'm sure we can talk more of the specifics, but one of his first executive orders reinstating President Obama's military transgender policy.
Right.
That's a major issue that I think honestly didn't even get as much of attention as it deserved. But what that we talked about this last time I was on your show, but how elections have consequences. And just within a couple weeks of Joe Biden being in office, we now have this executive order going out that says that the government within the military will fund gender reassignment surgeries. Despite the fact that the Defense Department just a couple years ago reported that medical costs for service members with gender dysphoria, which is the medical term for transgenderism, medical costs for transgender service members was three times higher than for other service members before the Trump administration repealed that Obama-era rule. We can talk about some of these other executive orders, but the point is this moral revolution is moving very quickly, and Christians better pay attention and need to pay attention to what's taking place. And ultimately, we really need to go back to our Bibles and make sure we understand what God's Word says to these issues. Because if we're not firmly rooted in God's Word and what it says about marriage and gender and sexuality, we will be carried away by what our culture is telling mm-hmm. us.
You know, these things that are having an impact that you've mentioned, like the one for the military, and that being, even though it's an executive order, and I don't know, I've lost count, but the last count I heard, it was well over 40 executive orders that President Biden has already signed. And I know 17 of them, as I believe is the number, was done on day one. And these things are having sweeping ramifications, like you mentioned, in the military. And not only is that now affecting enrollment or recruitment or placement of people, but then there's this whole other side of medical and economic responsibility that the military and the United States taxpayers are picking up, whether they like it or not. We're picking up the cost for these surgeries to reassign this condition called dysphoria. And it's just mind-boggling, David, to think about what the end result is going to be after even 2 years of this. Many people are thinking already, okay, there's going to be some big changes in the next election, and that would be people's hope. But in 2 years' time, there's going to be a massive bill for all this, isn't it?
No, there will be, and especially when we're thinking about the military. So here at FRC, we have our executive vice president is retired Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin, who was actually one of the commanders for U.S. Army Delta Force. And he made a great point when this executive order was rolled out. He said something to the effect that, you know, every cent that is spent on politically correct exercises is money that could have been used to prepare our troops for war. And every second wasted in transgender sensitivity training is time that could have been spent on the rifle range. And
wow.
I think that's what I really appreciate the general's point on that, because what the Biden administration is doing right now with the military is essentially playing social experiments with the military. And, you know, the military exists to keep us safe. The military it shouldn't be the place where we're doing this controversial social experimentation. Unfortunately, though, what this is doing is just going to waste money, it's going to waste time, and potentially weaken the military. And I think that's what we need to, when we're having these policy conversations. And I've had policy conversations about people who say, well, you just must not love people who suffer from gender dysphoria or who are in the LGBT community. Not at all. I have friends in that community. I pray for people in that community. But the specific issue when it comes to the military really is military readiness and cohesion,
mm-hmm.
and we shouldn't be experimenting with these controversial social policies. Just frankly, the military is not the place for it.
You know, you think about this term called troop morale, military morale. There is a reality that when you are on the front line in battle, that you must know if you're going to be a successful warrior. And I've been going through reading in the book of 1 Samuel right now, and you could even see this in the battles that Israel fought against the Ammonites. You see the impact that morale has, the sense, the courage, the confidence that those that are on the front lines in our military have when they are thinking that they're in the right place, when they think that their soldiers in arms that are with them have their back. And if morale gets bad in the military, it can have a devastating impact, not only on them, but on our country as well.
Very well said, Mike. I agree with you. And I just go back to the point that, you know, the military exists to keep us safe, to protect us from threats. And if you look at the world scene, there are a lot of threats out there, whether it's Russia or whether it's China. You know, we need to be on high alert and to be vigilant, and to spend millions of dollars on gender reassignment surgeries and sensitivity training sessions simply doesn't serve the purpose that I think our military should serve. But what I'll add, Mike, is the fact that this executive order was signed so quickly, it's indicative. I really say that this is a symptom of a larger issue. And the larger thing behind this is Joe Biden's worldview. Mm-hmm. And this is showing up in other areas. So it's not just with the military. President Biden, on one of his first days in office, I think it actually was his first day in office, also signed Executive Order 13988. Which demanded that all federal agencies redefine sex to include sexual orientation and gender identity in their policies against sex discrimination. And that order explicitly expands upon the Supreme Court's ruling last summer on the Bostock versus Clayton County decision, which redefined sex in Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. And let me just break that down. That's a lot of, you know, words.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially what that is saying is that the Biden administration is saying that the word sex, wherever it appears, and for you know, decades and decades and decades in this country, going, you know, the word sex means biological sex, male or female. And unfortunately, the Supreme Court over the summer essentially said when it comes to employment, the word sex actually means sexual orientation and gender identity, which is something that those who wrote the Civil Rights Act of 1964 couldn't have possibly had in their mind, as Justice Alito pointed out in his dissent.
Mm-hmm.
But now what Joe Biden's doing is essentially taking that Supreme Court decision and applying it across the board. And I know just off air, you and I were talking about potentially this is going to have major implications when it comes to the school system, boys and girls being able to compete on separate sports teams, showers, locker rooms, changing facilities. All of these things are going to flow from executive orders like this, which, again, is flowing from an overall worldview that I think is taking us into a place that we've never been in this country that is really Christians need to be paying attention to what's going on.
Absolutely, because when these things are put in place, and I know that the coronavirus caused many of the public school students to come home, and whether or not their parents had ever planned to be homeschoolers, they found themselves schooling from their home. But I'm wondering if all of these orders and their implications in the public school systems, if that's not going to have a huge let's say a force or an effect of driving some of these parents to the point of saying, hey, this is not even a place to where I want my children to be. And that's just going to really cause a lot of chaos among teachers, among schools. It's just really going to be interesting, isn't it, to see how this is going to play out. Now, we can talk about these things. This is what's so scary to me, David, about them. And I couldn't agree with you more that parents need to be right on top of all of the implications for their kids. Because it's one thing to talk about these things as if they are almost like news stories or they're just facts. But when it comes down at the end of the day, we're talking about things that dramatically changes the atmosphere and environment for our children in schools.
Absolutely. And that's what's been disheartening, honestly, is that the Biden administration does seem bent on kind of a radical agenda that ignores reason, science, and basic common sense. And really, unfortunately, is, you know, the people that are going to be hurt the most are women and children.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm grateful to see, and thankfully here at FRC we work with state legislators, in response to this executive order and this issue that we've seen on the horizon now for some time, specifically when it comes to sports. You have these stories where men who identify as women are allowed to compete against female athletes. Well, already only 1 month into the new year, thankfully, we've seen state legislatures in five states, Hawaii, Mississippi, Montana, North Dakota, and Tennessee, have actually introduced bills that specify that only boys can compete on boys' teams and that only biological girls, can compete on girls' teams. And in Ohio, too, I have one of my good friends actually is a state legislator in Ohio who's introduced the Save Women's Sports Act. And it seems, we're talking about where we were 12, 13 years ago. It would have seemed ridiculous to think that we needed actual legislation to protect women's sports. But that's where we're at. And it's important, I think, for all of your listeners to stay engaged on this issue. I don't know exactly where Florida stands. I don't think Florida has necessarily an explicit law that would protect women sports and girls from having to compete against biological males. But it's something that here at FRC we're encouraging. And we have model legislation, bills that we've drafted that state legislators can introduce. Because these issues, like you just said, Mike, have real-world effects on some of the most vulnerable people in our society. And we, as Christians who know these truths, we need to be very vigilant in making sure that we're holding the line.
My guest today is David Claussen from the Family Research Council. David is the Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview. And boy, do we need those two things, understanding of what the Bible has to say, understanding what the biblical worldview would be, because friends, whether we realize it or not, we're facing days ahead that are unprecedented, and they're going to be full of opportunities for us to use these two things that David oversees at FRC. So glad he's here. We're going to be back with him in a moment. My guest today, David Claussen. My name is Mike Gilland. We're here on the Shepherd Radio Network, and we'll be right back. So honored to have on the line David Claussen from the Family Research Council. He's based right now in Washington, D.C. Been there for a couple of years, but David is a Central Florida guy, and he grew up right here in Orlando. And boy, oh boy, I'm sure there are aspects of D.C. that are fun and exciting. This year so far, I am sure you've had moments of wishing you were back in Florida.
That's true, Mike. I miss home. I miss the weather, miss the people. I think we talked about this the first time I was on your show, the fact that people don't realize it, but there really are thriving churches, thriving congregations. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of Christians here in D.C. that feel called to this kind of work. And so in that sense, it is encouraging to serve with so many other people who love the Lord in this kind of work.
Well, I know that even a lot of our congressmen and congressladies, congresswomen, not trying to be disrespectful there, are all, many of them are firm believers and really do have that sense of call on their lives and feel like they're doing the thing that God's called them to do by being a member, a representative of the United States Congress. And I am grateful for the stand that they're taking, because there's never been in the history of our nation, I don't think there's ever been a time any greater where their faith has been more challenged or maybe even up for a little bit of religious persecution. Based on what they believe and the faith that they have. But we're living, David, in a time where increasingly those that have faith in the Lord are being almost mocked openly and looked down upon by members of government. And that's just unprecedented. I know that people that I'm hearing, like Matt Staver, when they're representing people, pastors whose churches have been really almost singled out by members of the government in California. These things they're heartbreaking to hear, and yet that's where we are today.
You're right, Mike, and Matt Staver is a good friend. Him and I have actually traveled to Israel together, and so I love him and I love his ministry. And specifically what we've seen in the last 10 months, with the COVID-19 mandates and restrictions, you know, it's really interesting to hear these cases. And I know Matt Staver's in court in California, I think, this week for one of the cases.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, back – and so a lot of people say, oh, churches are just trying to be unruly and they don't want to submit to governing authorities. That's not true. And I've written about this actually pretty extensively. Back in March, by the end of that month, 99% of churches ceased in-person worship because, you know, they wanted to love their neighbors. They didn't understand what this virus was all about. Experts were predicting that millions of people could die. And so churches did their part and shut down. It was only until when you got to, you know, June and into July, when these cities and states were allowing tattoo parlors and abortion clinics and liquor stores to open and other businesses to open, but then these same mayors and governors were saying, but you churches, you can't open.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you can open,
yeah,
we're going to hold you to a different standard. The case that, I'll be honest, Mike, still blows my mind even when I talk about it, was the situation in Nevada, where the governor allowed casinos to open up to like 50% capacity, which some of those huge casinos meant that thousands of people could still go inside, whereas churches were held to a flat 50-person limit, or mm-hmm. it might have been a 100-person limit, but it was,
a fraction.
Could go to the casino,
yeah.
50 or 100 people could go into the church. And thankfully, we're starting to see courts, especially with the addition of Amy Coney Barrett on the Supreme Court, reverse some of those lower court rulings. But to your point, though, about general persecution, we're living in a time where George Barna, the pollster, tells us that only 6% of Americans have a Christian worldview. And if that's the case, which I believe it is, the vast majority of people out there don't understand our basic convictions and our basic beliefs. And so they're going to use something like COVID as an opportunity to kind of go after us. So they're not going to understand why Christians want to meet for worship. Mm-hmm. They're not going to understand why we believe it's necessary to gather together for preaching and for singing songs and prayer. And I think you're accurately describing the state of society and where we're at.
You know, when you think about the power that states have, there is something good. You mentioned this in the last segment, that a response to some of the executive orders, it's already been now taken by leaders of state governments.
Yes.
And so the state's power could become more interesting in the days that are ahead, because these governors of the states that says, we're not going to do it that way. And then ultimately, there's going to be a showdown, obviously, and the courts will without a doubt get involved. But states are a very important aspect of our governance, and they need to step up right now. Governors of states are going to be playing a major role in actually how some of these things weigh out.
Absolutely. State legislatures, governors. I know in Florida, Ron DeSantis, from my perspective, has been doing a pretty good job in mm-hmm. as far as dealing with the COVID coronavirus vaccine distribution, things like that. As well as making sure that churches are not treated unfairly. Because, you know, the pastors I talk to, you know, they're not asking for special treatment. They're just asking to be treated fairly. And unfortunately, I believe even today, as you and I are having this conversation, there's still six states that are holding churches to whether it's lowering the capacity or just not even allowing singing. They're just holding churches to an unfair standard mm-hmm. that other secular counterparts are not being held to. And that's in a nation that was founded on religious liberty, that is of concern. And it's why here at FRC, we're making sure we monitor all of this very closely to make sure that people are aware of what's going on.
And I really do appreciate the fact that Tony Perkins has been holding a weekly prayer meeting. And that is powerful and effective. I know he had one last night. And, you know, there are leaders that are on the line, but they invite people to join in, people across the country. And, boy, if there's ever been a time for people to pray, it's right now. We need to pray.
We do. And that's why it's a blessing to be here at FRC to follow someone like Tony Perkins. Those prayer conferences, you just mentioned them, you can go to prayvotestand.org. So put all those together, prayvotestand.org. And all of the recordings of these meetings are on there. And, you know, Tony's joined by pastors, members of Congress, and other faith leaders. And he started doing this before the election. And I think we were only going to do them through the election in November. But we just realized we need to keep praying. A lot of issues out there, and as Christians, we know we're called to cry out to God and to bring these before Him in prayer, and that's definitely what we're trying to do.
Well, one of the issues that came up in these early executive orders that President Biden put forth, we talked about transgenderism in the first segment. Another one was one that you mentioned a little bit earlier. I'd like for you to delve into that. That's the whole Mexico order. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was one of the new president's first official acts in office. I think he waited till week two to officially do this. Right on the eve, actually, the anniversary of Roe v. Wade. So a lot of, I know, pro-life leaders definitely saw that kind of as a slap in the face. But what he did is he rescinded the Protecting Life in Global Health Assistance Policy, more popularly known as the Mexico City Policy, which simply prevents federal funds from going to to foreign non-governmental organizations that either perform abortion or actively promote abortion as a method of family planning. Mexico City policy was first adopted in 1984 by then President Ronald Reagan, and unfortunately every Democrat president since then, Bill Clinton and then Barack Obama and now Joe Biden, have rescinded that policy. And what's, you know, interesting to point out, Mike, is, you know, one of the things about President Trump, a lot of people didn't really know where he stood on life when he was a candidate in 2015, 2016. But one of the things he did do in office was fulfill a campaign promise he made regarding federal funding and the use of taxpayer money for abortion by reinstating and expanding that so-called Mexico City policy, which did block the funding for international NGOs that either promote or perform abortion. But unfortunately, the new president wasted very little time in opening the floodgates, you could say, of our tax dollars going to fund overseas abortion.
You know, one thing I don't understand, and maybe someone can still explain this to me, is that with the call that President Biden made on his inaugural address for unity, it just seems like with all of these 40 plus, it's probably much more than that now, executive orders, it seems like that was only an expression and not something that's being followed on. There are no legs that's been put to that effort, at least from what I can tell. And it just seems that there is an agenda, a narrative, a direction that has been put into place. And it just seems that it just goes right down the middle of everything that a lot of people have believed and that the Bible teaches. And it just seems to just go right against that, right? It's like it's ripping it right through the heart.
No, it's true. And I watched the inauguration actually just three blocks from the Capitol where it was taking place. It was really neat. And I'll be honest, I think along with millions of Americans, noticed the theme of the president's speech about the importance of unity and the time we need to unify in the face of all these challenges that our nation's facing, especially with the pandemic. But it increasingly seems that the call for unity was actually a call for uniformity. The call for unity was actually a call to conform to the priorities of the left. And it's very disheartening. And not even just thinking of our social conservative issues, whether it's immediately rejoining the Paris Climate Accord or killing the Keystone Pipeline, which is going to cost a bunch of jobs.
And raise gas prices.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it sounded great. Even to this morning with the National Prayer Breakfast, the president again talked about the need for unity with all the threats that we're facing together. But, and, you know, you want to take anybody at their word. You want to give the new president a chance. You know, he's all of our presidents. You know, there's a lot of people that during President Trump's term said he's not my president. Well, no, the president is the president for all Americans. We should all want Joe Biden to succeed. If he succeeds, America succeeds. But increasingly, those calls for unity are ringing hollow, and it's something that we need to follow closely and be drawing attention and calling him to account. And that's what we're trying to do here at FRC, is to really underscore what increasingly seems like empty promises.
You know, when you guys are watching policy there at FRC, and it's happening across the country right now, and you guys, I know, are in every state, But when you look at what's happening in California with the recall efforts of Newsom, what are you seeing happening there, David?
Yeah, that's been a really interesting case with the governor, and I think that's largely been fueled by his crackdown and locking down the state with the COVID-19 restrictions. And it's interesting to see how that and this is a real caution to all of us who are in the public eye or leaders, but it seemed like that recall petition really accelerated when it was shown that Governor Newsom was violating his own guidance.
Yeah.
He told people not to go out, to stay at home, and yet he was photographed at a ritzy dinner place, and he had to come out and apologize for it. But, you know, I think the hypocrisy is what really was galling for many people in California. And it does. I think I didn't see it. I think I heard the numbers was I think they needed 1.5 million signatures, probably a little bit more than that, because when they start counting them, I'm sure some will get thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there will be a recall election in California. Don't know what will happen in that, but I think that's a reminder that our actions and our words and our lifestyles, especially as Christians, you know, we're called to be congruent. We're called to have that what we say needs to line up with what we do. And I think when people don't see that in their leaders, they rightfully get upset by the hypocrisy. And I think that definitely is what happened in California.
Mm. My guest today is David Claussen, and he is the director of Christian Ethics and the Biblical Worldview at the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. I'll be back with David coming up in just a moment. This is Afternoons with Mike right here on The Shepherd. Back again with David Claussen. David is with Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. He is the guy who directs the Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview. And these things that we've been talking about, all of the impact of President Biden's executive orders, one of the things that, and by the way, I had a nice chat on my program yesterday with Dan Darling. And it turns out you know Dan Darling.
I do. Dan, when he served at the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, I did an internship in 2015 while I was in seminary, actually, and got to know Dan, and he's now with the NRB, National Religious Broadcasting Conference, and they're doing really good work.
Well, he spoke highly of you and was excited to realize that you were going to be on my program the very next day, and that was pretty exciting, but you know, all of these things, he and I were talking about the impact on free speech, what Americans have long regarded as being able to speak freely. And of course, that there have always been limits on that. That doesn't mean you can say anything. You can't make personal threats. You can't do that kind of thing. But with our constitutional rights being what they are, and the ability that our founders wanted us to have to be able to be a society and a culture to speak freely. And again, as you wisely said, it was all based on the ability to congregate freely and serve God freely without religious persecution, without state order. All of these things that are happening now are starting to look like there is at least a future battleground on churches and the impact of pastors in their preaching from a pulpit. What are you seeing happening there?
Yeah, that's an important issue with churches, and it's why one of the issues we care so deeply about is the issue of religious freedom. And I actually spoke this morning to a group of, actually it was the full group of FRC interns. We have a really robust internship program that students who are in about to graduate college or in graduate school, like law school or seminary, can join us for a semester. And so I actually spoke this morning on the issue of religious freedom, and I think it's important to define our terms. And religious freedom is, we believe, is the freedom to believe what you want in terms of doctrine or theology and to live in accordance with those beliefs. And, you know, one of the things, Mike, you'll remember during the Obama administration was you heard it was a slight shift, but an important shift, where you begin to hear the president and people who worked with him refer to the freedom of worship rather than the freedom of religion. And, you know, freedom of worship is problematic, though, because it kind of implies that you're free to do what you want within the four walls of your church or synagogue or mosque. But as soon as you pull off the church parking lot, you kind of have to leave your religious views at the door. And I'm afraid that there are many on the more progressive secular left that are going to really want to go in that direction. And we need to be clear. And, you know, as Christians, we believe that religious freedom is a good thing, that all it provides a broad path to the gospel. But we also need to stand up for our constitutional First Amendment protections with the Free Exercise Clause, the Establishment Clause that definitely protects pastors and really all Americans, but pastors as well, from being able to speak without fear of interference or coercion from the government. And even some of the executive orders we've just talked about with gender identity, sexual orientation, there's some people that want to classify speaking against those things as hate speech. And we need to hold the line and make sure that our elected officials know that we value, as Americans, our First Amendment protections to be able to say what we want and to live our life in accordance to our deeply held beliefs.
At FRC, when you talk about the fact that you are looking at these things, you're monitoring what's going on state by state, what do you give, let's say, as the health reading for the rights of Americans in our First Amendment? And also something that I was listening to on in an interview with Dan Sylia's show, he was talking to someone that was basically with the Second Amendment Foundation, and that had to do with the right to bear arms. And there's already a like work up and getting prepared for what could be a battle, an onslaught against both of our first two amendments, First Amendment and Second Amendment. What are you seeing in particular with those battlegrounds?
Right. And, you know, I don't think I'm an alarmist, but I'll be honest with you, Mike. I am concerned. The last couple of months, what we've seen with big tech in the censorship, whether it's Facebook and Instagram or Twitter or Google, kind of in the whole cancel culture impulse, you know, this movement that if we don't like what you think or we like what you believe, we're going to cancel you or deplatform you. And it's one of the reasons I think, like, more conservative media outlets like Newsmax and One American News Network, they're doing well. Parler is kind of a rival of Twitter. You have Rumble that's now kind of a rival to YouTube. And you're kind of seeing these other kind of platforms emerge because there's a real fear that I know Twitter actually kicked off or suspended the account. One of the focus on the family accounts because they put out a tweet that said one of Biden's appointments, who is a transgender individual, that they just pointed out the fact that this is actually a biological male, and they classify that as hate speech.
Oh, yeah.
So when it comes to these First Amendment issues of speech, we're concerned, and why we're making sure that all of our content isn't dependent on social media. Because if we get canceled by social media, we don't want all of our eggs in that basket. And so I think it's something that we do need to be very vigilant in protecting.
Do you see the day where the actual internet itself, I know that the internet is the train on which all of the social media giants ride. All of these things are part of that. And, you know, it only takes a moment to go a little deeper and say, okay, who's controlling, who's watching over the internet? Because we are seeing now what happens to groups like Parler, and there seems to be some deeper even issues happening in Parler itself, as I was looking at that even today. But all of these other groups, let's say there is a rival group that is run by conservatives, and that is going to be their new social media. Do you see the day that the internet itself could be so restricted that that effort to calm or to shut down, to cancel out the conservative voice could happen?
It's something that we need to be thinking about. And honestly, a couple of months ago, I would have probably said that we didn't need to be worried about these things. But it's why that as conservatives and as Christians, we need to really be building up kind of our own institutions, whether that's our Christian media groups, our Christian nonprofits, our Christian universities and colleges, and even obviously our churches. I think we really do need to be making sure that we are building up our own institutions, our own mediums of communication. You just need to be prepared for the day that those who control the levers of power for the kind of the mainstream communication networks kind of try to pull the plug on us. And so I think we do need to be really taking a close look at how are we getting our message out, what are we relying on, and to be as independent as possible, so we're ready for when that day comes.
Well, this is so helpful because so many people, David, are really asking these questions, and you've touched on so many things that are so helpful. In a word, what would you say could be the very first thing that people, our listeners, believers across Florida right now, who are hearing you and saying, yeah, man, I obviously beyond just getting on the bandwagon and supporting FRC, which I would highly recommend and encourage, what can people do? Where can they go to read up, to catch up, to equip themselves to be ready?
It's a good question. And of course, at FRC, we have a lot of resources. We send out a daily email that you can subscribe to on our website, frc.org. But the advice that I give to people that I talk to is make sure, there's the national conversation is so divisive and combative, but make sure you're just investing in your local church. Join your local church. Become an active member. Be a part of disciple-making relationships. And I think as we do that and as we strengthen the bonds of the body of Christ, come what may from the culture, when we're standing together, we'll be able to stand stronger. And so it's simple advice, but just getting plugged into our local churches and being faithful members of those bodies, I think would go a long way to making sure that every Christian out there knows they're not alone and that there's brothers and sisters who are standing with them.
And I think, too, to add to that, friends, read the Bible. Go back into getting into a good habit. Join a Bible reading plan. Get involved in the Word. Talk about your faith with your friends. Get together. Pray. Love what Tony's doing nationally. And praying is such a thing that we just can benefit so much from. And thank God we have a God who is over all. His sovereignty has not been diminished since the inauguration. I'm so grateful to know that, David. And thank you, my friend, for being with me back here once again on the program. I so look forward to having you back.
Well, thank you so much, Mike, and I definitely look forward to joining you again.
David Clausen, he is the Director of Christian Ethics and Biblical Worldview with Family Research Council. Friends, thank you for being with me one more time here on the program, and we'll catch you next time on the Shepherd Radio Network.